for all the help that he gives us as consultants and helping us, he and Mr. Bill Norman, and there's several other people with the Cotton Council that deserve a lot of recognition. Mr. Don really helps helps us all organize this event, and I really appreciate it. So take the podium, Mr. Don.
Thanks, sir, Mr. Chairman. And most of the thanks goes back to the people who really organized this, and that goes to consultants and researchers. And so thank all of y'all for what y'all do, the research extension and the consultants. You're what makes all of this come together right. If you haven't started thinking about what you're going to do tonight and what drinks you want, you're about to. All the good stuff's over with. The bad news is here, as usual. So I just want to make it clear up front, you know, I don't deal with good news. Just to give you kind of a glance at, okay, kind of what went on last year within the National Cotton Council and the product registration. Well, this starts it. So here you got the first one, NAC, 2,4-D, Zephyr, Brigade, which is in the bifenthrin, that's part of the pyrethroids, Courier, which is one of our white fly products, Bathroid, another pyrethroid, Emamectin benzoate, which is your denim insecticide, the Brake herbicide, and then you make sure you don't forget that we got the neonic still rolling through there, the clothianidin, dinetifurin, imidacloprid, thymethoxam. Oh, by the way, we're still working on the organophosphates. So acephate, your favorite for years and years, has at this point a slim chance of surviving. Okay, just to make it point blank clear. The risk assessments that have come out on that, we have a ways to go before we will be able to retain that product. Cypermethrin, which is another pyrethroid, Roundup, I'm sure y'all have heard the news on what's going on all of that. The Fulfill insecticide is still, you know, we've put comments on that. That's a big one that's going on. Staple, pathoxamid, that is a new herbicide coming to send some countries already. Then we had the BT panel, and the National Cotton Council was very pleased to nominate and support Drs. Rogers Leonard, Charles Allen, and some of the others that did get to serve on the BTSAP. We were very pleased that finally we were able to get some Mid-South people and Southern crop people that understood field level corn and cotton interface to serve on that committee. And so that was we thought that was a very good thing. We also have been looking at some the other issues around, and I'm going to go back to that acephate and talk about it. It's not just acephate, okay? So this is where, now I've given you kind of a snapshot of, hey, here's a list of all the things that's been going on this year. And I'm talking about these things are books of stacks of risk assessment that I have to try to wade through and figure out what are they actually saying. Organophosphates, let's kind of group it down for a second. We, over the past couple of years, have had a change in, before this change in administration, there was a change in view of organophosphates within the federal agencies, in particular EPA. And so there were these new studies that came out called epidemiology studies, and there was one in particular that created a lot of concern around organophosphates. Now, the study itself was on one organophosphate, chlorpyrifos, and it was sprayed inside a house, and it was followed for a period of time, and the researchers claim that years later they detected a 4-point decrease in IQ for those children who were they followed expecting mothers, and so those children later on they detected a trend for a 4-point decrease in IQ. Okay. Now, it's a correlation. You can come up with correlations all day, but you throw them down there to say, okay, did that really cause it? That's where the challenge comes in. And so the scientific advisory panel was put together by EPA after quite a push from several groups, including us. And their own scientific advisory panel sat there and looked at all of it and started talking about, wait a second, there's all kind of gaps in this. There's all kind of problems with this study. And the research, the study is only a report, and the researchers will not even give us this report, the data, to let us independently analyze the way the conclusion that they came up with. EPA itself asked them, can we have the data to look at this and analyze it ourselves? And this researcher says no. So EPA can't get the data, and yet they're going to give it more weight and influence than 40 years of data that they have mandated that were done under strict laboratory practices, under strict guidelines and regulations, but they're going to give this more weight. Well, that's what's put all of the organophosphates in jeopardy. Not just acephate, not just chlorpyrifos, but acephate, chlorpyrifos, Bidrin, the organophosphate defoliant DEF, it is also a target. And any of the organophosphates you can talk about, what they have done is they have said, okay, that's given us reason to add some new safety factors to the risk assessment. And so they take whatever the risk was and they say, we're going to add a 1x safety or a 10x safety factor for expecting mothers and a 10x safety factor for children and a 10x safety factor for this. And all of a sudden you got 10 by 10 by 10, and that number then gets multiplied by the risk number, which just, you can see, would just blow up the risk number. So then all of a sudden you're saying, okay, this exceeds our level of concern. Well, yeah, you had enough multipliers in there, it's going to. And so that's where we are. Now, that is a big issue for our industry, because then how they end up taking on how they handle epidemiology studies is going to be critical. It's going to impact everything from here forward. If they start taking on these epidemiology studies and really don't stick to does it show causation, then it's going to change all risk assessments from here out for every product. And that's really scary whenever you think about it. These epidemiology studies go way back, and they have been used a lot of times in trying to look at trends across groups through disease type scenarios. So where you have disease type outbreaks to look at, okay, there's an outbreak of a disease here. How do we look at behavior and health of things to try to bring that in and determine what was the cause of this disease outbreak? How did this disease spread? That type of... So they have been around for quite a while, but more related to a disease-type scenario rather than... I mean, what's going on now is trying to interpret to say that a change in IQ was somehow a result of a mother's exposure during maternity stage. That's really hard to fit into the definition that CDC has with what is an epidemiology study. And even if you look just at the Webster type dictionary, branch of medical science that deals with incidence, distribution, and control of disease in populations. So where these studies are going at is they're saying, okay, if we've got a segment of the population that's around agricultural fields and settings, and we see that there is a higher incidence of children with autism in those settings, then can we see that there is more of this chemical used in that setting than in other settings? Well, if it's an ag chemical, the likelihood's pretty high, okay? And so then there's a correlation, and they say, oh, well, it must be this chemical that causes it. And it doesn't take into a lot of other socioeconomic factors that are in play. So it's a very difficult road for us being going down, especially when you can't get the data, you can't see the data, you don't know what the studies were. And EPA's own scientific advisory panel, the majority of the panel said, hey, there's several things here that aren't known. Scientifically, we're not sure that this size molecule can pass into the womb. And there's some studies that says this size can't even get there. And we're not sure that this, we're not even sure that this is possible for this to even be considered a contaminant. So with the weaknesses that are in the data and everything, although it may raise a question, at this level, there is now this is the scientific advisory panel. They said at this point, the data that we have before us is not sufficient to make regulatory policy. Apparently, that was just a suggestion that EPA at this point has not taken to heart. So they have not ruled out these epidemiology studies. They still have them in their risk assessments. Now, there is a new clause out there called a strengthening transparency in regulatory science. And EPA says they have not dropped this. They are looking at this still. They are trying to find out how to make it fit. And basically it's going to say that, hey, whatever we make our determination on is going to have to be publicly available. We have to have the data. If you want us to use it, you got to give us the data, and it's got to be publicly available. Well, that's good in the sense of that Columbia study, they'd have to turn over their study. But then again, it creates us challenges on confidential business information that companies are looking at trying to get a product registered, and how do they get their product registered in this transparency. So we've got a complicated area there. I want to jump from that now to Endangered Species Act and FIFRA, and this is really critical. How many of you here understand the difference in FIFRA and Endangered Species Act? Anybody? Okay, so please catch this. This is our nightmare coming, and I mean rapidly coming. Endangered Species Act was passed afterwards. So FIFRA comes first. All right, FIFRA is the federal fungicide, insecticide, for EPA to register pesticides based on science and based on risk benefit analysis. All right, now Endangered Species Act comes along and it says, okay, Fish and Wildlife Services are these protectors of species. And if it's an endangered species, any government activity that may threaten endangered species has to have a consultation process with Fish and Wildlife before they can move forward. That was essentially the thought process at that time is, okay, if you're building a highway through an area, you got to go sit down with this group of biologists at Fish and Wildlife. Well, after it became the law, the legal interpretation of that is, wait, EPA, you can't register that product until Fish and Wildlife Services agrees with you that it doesn't cause problem for endangered species. And EPA says, we've done the risk-benefit analysis here. with stacks and tons of data, and here's all of our data. And Fish and Wildlife says, no, we're not bound by data. By law, we are asked to do a biological opinion. Wouldn't y'all like to have that job? All right, so the biological opinion says you can't have data on an endangered species because it's endangered. So you can't study it and you don't know how sensitive it is. So you have to assume it's extremely sensitive. And so our opinion is this would damage it. And you haven't given us anything on tank mixes and everything, and you would be amazed how it'll go. So ESA mandates that federal actions get the approval of Fish and Wildlife. They lack manpower to do anything. They're only bound by a biological opinion. They don't have to take in economic considerations for risk-benefit. They're told protect the species. And if they don't, they get sued. Right? EPA is under FIFRA. They're mandated for a timely review of pesticides. They have to do a FQPA, Food Quality Protection Act, on drinking water safety for humans, on food dietary safety for humans, and then combine that for human safety, and that gives you your human, that gives you FQPA, and then they go through all of these risk assessments for ecological, terrestrial, and all this other stuff until they finally get all those risk assessments done to do their benefits, risk-benefit analysis, and then they have to say, okay, we think that this product is totally safe through the ecological and everything, so we're ready to do it, and our data supports it, and Fish and Wildlife says, we haven't looked at it yet, give it to us, and so they'll send it over, and Fish and Wildlife, and EPA says, wait, by law, we got to have it by this date. Fish and Wildlife says, well, we're not going to have it by then. We're not ready yet. We haven't been able to look at it, and all of a sudden, they get sued. Okay? That's where we are. Totally honest. A couple of years ago, I told you about Endangered Species Act was getting touchy and talked about endangered species listing of the rusty patch bumblebee. And even in some of the memos that were put together around it, it said neonicotinoids were one of the factors that were probably responsible. Come to find out, the rusty patch bumblebee is mainly in national parks that don't allow any neonics to be used. So where did that, well, it don't matter. It got in the press one time and that's all that mattered. The damage was done. Right now, watch the press. You'll see tons of press about declining Barnock populations. And they are telling you that these populations are lower than they've been for years. I don't dispute that. They don't get into that that's largely because of some destruction of the population's overwintering habitat. And there's nothing that we can do about that because that's not within the jurisdiction of our country. They don't get into drought conditions that have been extreme over the past couple of years that have influenced the habitat of them. What they talk about is these long-term stressors are we need paying attention to. We cannot change the weather to prevent occasional wet late springs, droughts, wildfires. What we can and should be working on is addressing and reversing widespread habitat losses and pesticide use throughout the monarch range. They have petitioned Fish and Wildlife to list the monarch butterfly as an endangered species. Fish and Wildlife didn't respond. So now they sued Fish and Wildlife. In this past year, the courts told Fish and Wildlife, you've got to respond. So now Fish and Wildlife is in the process of coming forward with their listing. It will probably end up being listed as an endangered or threatened species. If it does, can you imagine how that's going to change all of our pesticide programs? Because all of a sudden, every product that you're using has to be approved through, if you have an area that monarchs fly through, all of a sudden you have to go through the ESA FIFRA consultation. Here's another one talking about the monarch population is decreasing. And I'm going to hit this one just a little bit. Legal petition urges feds to severely restrict pesticides in the endangered species critical habitat. So they are, there's some legal challenges they have just put forward on ESA saying, on EPA saying, hey, you haven't complied with ESA. And now they've petitioned Fish and Wildlife Services saying, hey, under ESA, you have the legal authority here. And so we want you to step in and take over this regulation away from EPA, because you're the one that actually has the statutory mandate when it comes down to these endangered species. So we want you to reverse some of the things EPA has registered. And that's a very recent, you can see January the 7th, that came out. So these are some very recent pushes that are taking place. So what I expect to see over the next couple of years, I think what we're going to see is about 2 years that is not going to be terrible. And then we're going to see a tremendous time of challenge. And I mean tremendous. I think that we're going to see a lot of push for larger buffer restrictions or buffer sizes. We're going to see pushes for more restrictions on nozzles and things, more wind restrictions, vegetative buffers, because all of that's in the literature, all of that's in the documents right now. The pyrethroids, they're talking about some of these different restrictions that they're going to add to them. So all of this looks like the way they are moving. Bidrin, they're talking about taking away aerial application, totally. So all of this is the cloud before the storm. The storm's coming after it. Now, the reason I want to point that out to you so strong is because what it's come down to is we oftentimes pride ourselves as an agricultural community and our care and preservation of the land. And if we want to maintain our products, we're going to have to become more creative in making certain that us as a community, not only as an individual, but that we as a community use our products in the most careful stewardship manner, that our product stays where we apply it. And that's where we've got to move to. And that's going to be some new changes, whether those are formulations, whether those are our hooded sprayers, or we've got to get creative. And we've got to come together as a community to make sure that we, as an agricultural community, know that our product stays where we apply it. I will tell you that several of you have asked about sulfoxaflor. Yeah, it's still, they're trying to get a Section 3 on it. They won't have it in time this year. And I have talked to EPA. They are aware that there's going to be some applications for Section 18s and for those, and they understand the justification for those. I want you to know December 26th of, just a couple of weeks ago, there was a new federal notice that was released, and it's because that EPA has been petitioned after they've already lost one lawsuit, but they have been, the group lost a lawsuit. The Center for Food Safety believes EPA improperly applied the treated article exemption. So there is a period now where that EPA is asking for public comments on this. What the Center for Food Safety wants is they want the seed to be treated like a jug of pesticide. The seed. Okay? And that is going to, if they are able to push that, that is going to change the whole dynamics of everything. That is not the way the law is written. The law is written is that EPA regulates it up to the point of application. The application is made on a seed, and then EPA has done its job, okay? And then you take a bag of seed and you go plant it, but those seeds have been treated, right? So it is a treated article, just like some treated wood that you buy at the lumber store, different things like that. And Center for Food Safety is challenging that. If you went to this site and you type in, just Google regulations.gov, you'll get a little window pops up like this. And then you can type in that search up there, seed treatment, or either, actually I knew what the number was, so I typed in the number, and if anybody gets in touch with me and wants that number, I'll be glad to get it to you. Several of you already know that it's coming to you because y'all know how I rely on you, and I appreciate you. And you type in that number right there at regulations.gov, and it will pop up a screen right here, and you see there right there at the top, it says petition seeking revised testing requirements prior to pesticide registration, notice of availability. All right, you see right down there under there, you see where it says comment now? You click on that button right there, and it'll throw you up a little blank page that you can write your thoughts about that and your comments in. And that's then whenever you finish writing that, you hit submit, and you have just weighed into EPA on your belief, your feeling around that. So that is how you can make a public comment. And those are needed. As I just told you what the Center for Food Safety is saying, it says that EPA has done this wrong, and so that number, you can remember EPA headquarters, HQ, OPP, Office of Pesticide Policy, 2018. So the only hard part there is trying to remember 0805. And you type that in, that's going to get you that docket where you can comment on this. With that, I'm going to stop because I'm sure I probably have run out of time. Answer to that question. I do want to make sure that this is clear. I sincerely thank all of the extension research people here who help provide me data and input whenever I send out these blasted emails and says, hey, I need response here. And they blast me back, and I appreciate that so much. To the cotton producer organizations that often tell us they can add our name to it, we thank you very much for that. For all the consultants who weigh in and help us with this information and actually help us sit down and figure out some of the timelines at times, I thank you. You just don't know how valuable that really comes out to be. And for all the companies as well, because they are very helpful whenever I reach out to them and I say, look, I'm reading through this risk assessment and I just got into this epidemiology study and I'm looking at the risk quotient on PODs and I don't know what it is. And they'll get someone to try to help me get a better understanding. So I do thank all of these people for let's work together and pull together and see if we can't continue to be good stewards of agriculture. Thank you.
Thank you, Don, and allow me to express my sincere gratitude to you as well for being the good point man that you are for all these issues. And